Hello, welcome to Holyrood Ungacked, Scotland's premier political podcast. Well, another week in Scottish politics. I'd say it's been a bit of a quieter week than the last few. Normally, round about the Wednesday, I start panicking that we'll have nothing to talk about. That was the same this week. Last few weeks, there's been a lot of stuff happened over the weekend that sort of then my panic of having nothing to talk about switches to, oh my God, how are we going to talk about all these things? But like I said, quieter week this week, but there's still stuff we can talk about. There was a surprising article from Kenny McCaskill that was advocating a sort of form of Devo Max or federalism. I suppose not surprisingly, we heard a bit more Tory corruption as a businessman was handed a peerage directly for Boris Johnson, despite the Peers Committee advising that it wouldn't be a good idea. Then Nicola Sturgeon came out to sort of dispel some rumours and that's been floating about the SNP's finances over the last kind of couple of months. And then we also had Douglas Ross in Pride Month deciding to wear a rainbow pin to Parliament. I think that surprised a lot of people, given the Scottish Tories and Douglas Ross's, in particular, his attitude to LGBT rights over the last few years has been somewhat lacking, shall we say. Well, this week, it's our usual lineup. We've got the Pizza Hut Prince, Brian Finlay. He'll be joining us, along with the Mulguy's Digital Michelangelo, Deborah Torrance. Well, I hope you're excited about this, as excited as I am, certainly. I'm sure you can hear it in my voice. Let's get ungagged. And it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice to hear you smile. Well, welcome guys. How's doing? Another fun packed week in Scottish politics. How have you been? Enjoying the nice summer weather?
Good, thanks. It's roasting, isn't it? Even in Dundee, it is hot. I think it's like 19 or 20 degrees today. Roasting.
The summer has arrived in Scotland. It will be here for the next 48 hours, maybe.
If we're lucky.
Big week in Scottish politics where it got to 20 degrees.
A big week in my house as well. It was one of my daughter's birthdays yesterday, so we had loads of six-year-olds running about in the garden, and we were glad of the warm weather then because it can get very loud if you have to let them in the house.
Absolutely. It's good that you've got a big garden at the back, just let them run wild.
Playing the new zip line that we get put in.
Get
a zip line.
That's exciting.
It is. Not so much for me because I'm too heavy for it, but exciting for smaller people like my wife.
I had a shot
at least twice.
Yeah, I had a shot on a zip slide. I was down visiting Falkirk, visiting my family, and they've got a big huge one in Callander Park, and I went for a walk really early on a Sunday morning and I had a shot on the big flying fox zip line thing before there was any kids in the park. It was really good fun.
Brilliant. I want a shot in your zip line, David.
Anytime.
Yes.
Now that we're on level 2 and we can move between local authorities without fear. Okay, let's get started then, talking about politics. That's what we're all here for. So what did people think about the... I was kind of surprised to hear Kenny McCaskill, former elected as an SNP Member of Parliament, but now ALBA Member of Parliament, wrote an article, was it in The National? Basically agreeing with Gordon Brown that maybe we should be looking at a kind of Devo Max federal solution to the terrible divisions we currently face in Scottish politics. I take it he's read the article?
Yeah. I gave it a look over. it was interesting. I mean, considering that how much hassle certain representatives in SNP got for suggesting further devolution, you know, decentralised powers from the people who then left to go to ALBA, I thought it was a wee brass neck, really, wasn't it? The Max the Yes has turned into the Max the Devil. Who knew?
That's a really good hashtag there for the next campaign.
No, Max the Devil.
I think we found the title of this week's podcast.
Yeah, Max the Devil. It was an interesting proposal that just kind of came out of nowhere. I don't think that was the official line of ALBA during the Scottish elections. Yeah, again, Kenny McCaskill agreeing with Gordon Brown wasn't something that I thought would kick off the podcast for this week, which was a really, really strange one. And it just seems, you know, we've got the, I think it was it Chris McKelney as well, was mentioned in one of the newspapers, I think it was The National, about, you know, saying that ALBA was going to use their position at Westminster to try and bring about another independence referendum, really apply the pressure for that. And I was like, you've only got two MPs and they can't even agree what they're doing. So it's really quite interesting.
Yeah, it was a strange one. I mean, it was a sort of article that if it had came for like a, I don't know, some, not necessarily Gordon Brown, but like a Labour sort of grandee, a George Fulks or something like that, yeah, I'd just been like, oh, same old story, like. But the fact it was coming for Kenny McCaskill, who, like you were saying, has just defected to the party that claimed that they're the one true party of Scottish independence. The Greens, they don't really believe in independence. The SNP, they're not really in favour of independence. It's all about ALBA. ALBA are the supporters. They're the real indie people. And now one of their MPs is saying, well, maybe Devo Max is enough.
You would expect actually that perhaps Scottish Labour would come out with that policy by now, bearing on the way that the election's sort of fallen and, you know, the outcomes and things like that. But I literally came out of nowhere. So, and it was not like, it was almost like there was like a group of people asking for that, or, you know, in the pro-indie movement thinking, oh, you know, independence, that's a long shot. You know, if we go for Defo Max, we might, you know, have a majority support for that. It just kind of came out of nowhere. I've seen no demand for it at all. The only person that I've ever heard talking about it is Gordon Brown and people like Neil Findlay looking for some kind of compromise of like a, you know, home rule. It's bizarre.
Devo Max is one of the things that there was a time for it, and that time has most certainly passed.
Kind of passed.
Yeah, I mean, 2014, if they'd allowed a sort of Devo Max option on the referendum, I think it would have won hands down. You know, like, I don't know if you'd do a sort of, like, preference system if there was more than one option, but if it was a sort of pick one of the three, I think it would have been, like, 70% Devo Max, like, easy. Because there's a lot of these sort of unionist voters or people that voted no, you know, they were open to a greater devolution. And even a lot of people that voted yes, you know, with maybe a wee bit of trepidation leaping into the unknown, Devo Max would have been a much more safer bet. But I mean, the time of that's come and gone. Nobody's interested in that now.
Was there not chat at the time of the first independence referendum of a third option, and it was sort of poo-pooed as a absolutely no chance? Because as you said, it would probably win.
Yeah, I think Alex Salmon did raise it at one point, and, you know, it was David Cameron and the Tories down south that absolutely launched it into the long grass, like, no interest at all. You know, it was, and I think that's because at that time they were very confident of a heavy, heavy no vote in the early days of this, when the referendum was getting discussed.
Yeah, the support. You know, when the campaign officially launched, I think it was 28%, something like that, there or thereabouts, which is actually quite interesting that support for Welsh independence has sort of peaked around that point as well. So to bear that in mind, that where Wales is where Scotland was, you know, before the 2014 referendum. So that's something to keep an eye on as well. But Yeah, I think like with the Devo Max thing, like you say, if that had been an option, that would have won outright. And really, neither side would have been content with that. So the SNP wouldn't have been content with that. And the Tories certainly don't want to give away any more, a Devo Max home rule style thing. But the only kind of fair way that they could really do that, because if you've got a three-way sort of referendum, that's, it's really, really difficult to, it's a bit of an odd one, but you could actually have like a first preference of a yes and no. If no wins, then you could go to like a second question of, do you keep unionism the way it is, or do you go for a home rule style? I don't know, like a kind of drop down preference. How would that work?
I suppose it would be a bit like the vote to establish a Scottish Parliament, where you'd do you want a Scottish Parliament, yes or no?
Yes, and yes.
Do you want it to have a tax varying powers?
Yeah. So do you want independence? Yes, no. And then do you want Devo Max?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I suppose that's how it could potentially work.
The days of a yes, yes, that takes me back to my teenage years.
Yes, yes, it does.
Hey, another thing I thought was quite interesting about that article, initially when I just heard about it, I thought it's maybe just been an interview and like an offhand,
mm-hmm.
he said something offhand and it's just kind of made headlines. But it was more in depth, it did seem as if, a lot of the framing of it I thought was very strange. It was very unionist framing in terms of, how terribly divided and the country is. And, it's usually kind of the Tories that are coming out with stuff like that, portraying Scotland as this landscape where families are all ripped asunder as if it's some kind of state of near civil war. And in reality, it's not like that. I mean, you look at the polls are very split in terms of, around about 50-50 and whether people want independence or not. But it's not like we're at each other's throats over it. It's not as if people are only talking to pals and things like that. And, it's that kind of thing. It's, people who mistake Twitter for real life, and Twitter, everything's sort of life and death and extremes, whereas people just aren't quite like that in reality.
And people are different spectrums of yes and no as well, because I know people, when I'm having political discussions around, the Scottish election results and things like that, there's people that I know that will support staying in the UK and nobody will ever change their mind. But there's people that are, they voted no in 2014 but are more open-minded this time. And there's people who are yes because, they're not, they won't be persuaded one way or the other. So everyone's on a spectrum. There is no binary, I'm going to vote this and I'm never going to change. So, and to kind of paint it that way as if, people who voted yes in 2014 don't speak to people who voted no in 2014 is just ridiculous, and that they're somehow ripped apart. There's people that I know that, in my family and things like that, that vote certain ways with certain political parties, but it doesn't mean I don't speak to them. We don't hate each other. It's just, I think it's just such a strange framing. It's like, politics is divisive, but a lot of people are in some way quite ambivalent towards politics and engage during a campaign and vote a certain way, So I just think this is just a bit daft.
Yeah, and I don't really understand why an ALBE MP is taking up that sort of framing that the unionists have been pushing this for ever since the referendum, that, the referendum has been terrible for Scotland. It's, everybody's bitterly divided and, it's just not the reality. And I don't know why ALBE are seemingly buying into that kind of unionist viewpoint now.
Maybe it's less unionist and more just a wee bit right wing. Like, we all sort of thought ALBE was, fulfilling that independence, right wing sort of voter base.
Socially conservative.
Yeah. So maybe that's why they sound a wee bit Tory when they're saying it.
That's actually a really good point.
And true, going back to the sort of unionist argument of saying, it's everything's so divisive and, another independence referendum would be divisive. Yeah, we heard that argument at the three general elections we've had, since the independence referendum, and all the other elections and the other referendum that we've had being brought about by the UK government and the Tories. So it's always quite interesting when we hear that, you know, we can't have another independence referendum because that's really divisive, but we can have three general elections over Brexit because that's not quite as divisive.
I mean, I just, you know, politics is divisive by nature. I don't understand this whole, oh my God, it's so divisive, you know. Aye, it is. It's supposed to be. If we all agreed on everything, we wouldn't need, politics wouldn't exist. We would just do it. We would just do what everybody thought was right.
And that's why we have, you know, electoral systems in Scotland that's meant to try and encourage collaborative working and, you know, having the AMS system alongside First Past the Post to encourage, you know, parties that don't get more than 50 or 51% of the vote to work together to produce budgets and policy and all these types of things. So politics is divisive, but it's really just as divisive as our institutions and as our discourse allows it to be.
Yeah. I always find it's the politicians with the most divisive policies who are always shouting about everything being divisive, to be honest. Like Priti Patel and, you know, Gov and our lovely friend Willie Rennie, everything's so divisive. Maybe not Willie Rennie, he doesn't really, he's not divisive on anything, is he?
It's that kind of thing. It's don't be divisive, be criticising the horrific policies I'm trying to pursue, you know.
Yeah.
Don't be divisive about the constitution. I want to be divisive about this particular policy area.
It's like people getting accused of being divisive for calling it racism, and it's like, well, surely the racism bit's the divisive bit. Calling it out and trying to do something about it, that's the opposite. What is the opposite of divisive?
Inclusive.
Inclusive. Not divisive.
If everybody was just inclusive with all minorities and all people, then perhaps there would be less division because people are not excluded.
You've cracked it, Brian.
There you go.
What time is it? 7:20 on a Monday night. We have just solved racism and bigotry.
Thanks very much. See you later. Bye.
Okay, let's move on now to a recurring topic, which is the Tories are at it again. The now Lord Cruddas, who was a billionaire that was put forward for vetting for the Appointments Commission to be a peer and was rejected on the basis that it was inappropriate. But then the Prime Minister, our very own Boris Johnson, overruled that, which is seemingly unprecedented for a Prime Minister to do that, and decided that he should be appointed anyway. And in complete coincidence, 3 days after becoming a Lord, he donated £500,000 to the Conservative Party. Now, some divisive people out there are trying to make out that there's some connected there between him getting a peerage when everybody that usually makes these decisions said no. These divisive people are trying to say that Boris was swayed with this £500,000. I'm shocked. What's your take on that? I'm really sarcastic this week.
It really sets the tone actually for my response here to say, like, how can people not see this for what it is? And then yet people can make up wild ideas and conspiracy theories about stuff. But this just sort of is like, I mean, where do you even go with this one? It's so blatant. And, you know, yeah, it's so unprecedented for Boris Johnson to intervene on an unelected legislator being put into the second chamber at Westminster, even though it was advised against it. You know, it was the same thing happened when he shut down Parliament, you know, prorogued Parliament, so that we couldn't have a further debate around Brexit. So, you know, there's quite a lot of unprecedented things happening under Boris Johnson that doesn't seem to get the same media attention as what Trump did when he was doing quite similar things. And I think that's pretty concerning. I mean, there was really, really quite, you know, unprecedented things that Trump did that was rightly called out by the mainstream media over here and really, you know, covered to a really good extent. But it's Boris Johnson seems to be doing it in a much more, you know, just as an obvious way, but perhaps with not quite as much bells and whistles attached to it. So, you know, it just seems to be sliding through. So I think that that's something that we should be really deeply concerned about.
Was the guy not also at some point working for the Conservatives and getting access to folk? Was that not also a bit of a scandal?
Yeah, before? There was a scandal in 2012, but it seems a bit kind of debatable whether what he was doing and whether it was wrong. There was damages awarded, which is probably why you can hear the fear in my voice when we're discussing
this.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we want to make sure that we're being, you know, we're covering all the right bases here, but it would be a bit on the nose if that was the case, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, there was allegations that he was offering cash for access when he worked for the Tories. There was a court case and he was awarded damages. The Electoral Commission said he broke any rules. But then those damages were reduced a couple of years later on appeal.
Oh.
What really that means for the fact of the matter, I don't know. But what was undeniable, the vetting process said that it wasn't appropriate to give him a peerage.
Right. And then he sounds like an absolute solid gentleman who should most definitely be an unelected peer and in a position of power, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
Sorry, again with the sarcasm.
In fairness, by the standards of the House of Lords, you know, is he really that bad?
Well, you know, it's only, you know, a huge donation to the Tory party that he's just been given a lifelong job from. So, you know, whatever. But then, of course, this comes back to, like, you know, this whole situation that has happened is blatant. It's really, really quite concerning. But see, when you even take a step further back and say, why on earth are we allowing a prime minister to just pick people to go into a second legislative chamber for life anyway? You know, so it's like, you know, yeah, this is a really shocking story, and it should get the level of scrutiny which it hasn't got so far, and it should be just, you know, just as public as these blatant things that Trump was doing in America. But actually, like, let's take a real step back and go, you know, this isn't democracy. You know, even if these individuals, you know, some individuals that go into the Lords, you know, I'm sure they're great people, and I'm sure they mean well, and they want to go and do the right thing, but they're still given a role by the Prime Minister, whether they leave the post or on a cycle yearly basis. Like, I just find it baffling. And this is another thing I know, particularly in Scotland, we're not in favour of the House of Lords and very, very critical of it in general. But I mean, it's just nuts, isn't it?
To be slinging around donations of £500,000 as well, it's not like he's in dire need of a job, is it? Like, he's a multimillionaire, I presume.
He's a billionaire.
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 What's the bet that he still pick up his £250 a day in the House of Lords, though?
Easy.
Well, definitely a man of the people, by the sounds of it.
But it does make you think about what the motivations are for some of these folk, and why why would the Prime Minister interject himself and, you know, that sort of business. It's very peculiar.
Because at the end of the day, it's the ones that are dishing out the big donations or the ones that are pulling the strings.
Pulling the strings, giving out the donations, you know, essentially getting, you know, tax cuts, as we've seen, obviously, the G7 intervention. We'll yet to see how that goes, but given, you know, tax cuts for big businesses and continuing opening up of the free market doesn't come for free.
I thought it was quite interesting you were saying, Brian, about the kind of allusions to some of Trump's antics. Bear with me, this sounds a bit weird, but it made me think of an episode of The Tudors when Henry VIII was trying to get his divorce and somebody was advising the Pope on the matter. And they used this phrase where they said, my greatest fear that the lion finds out his own strength. And it was basically talking about how really all the kings of Europe were all sort of still sort of bending the knee to the Pope. But in reality, the Pope's power was all sort of smoke and mirrors. It was, they had power because the Popes thought they had power. And it's a bit like that in politics at the moment with the Tories and the Republicans in America. You know, somebody say, oh, we can't do that. And then somebody like Trump just says, well, I've done it. So what you got to do about it? And it turns out nothing. People will shout and get angry about it, and you know, CNN or something like that. And then a couple of days later, it's forgotten about it. He's done it. He's no consequences. And we're seeing things like that creeping in here.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's so worrying. I mean, look, you know, prime example at the time, you know, the prerogative of Parliament was, you know, that was covered, you know, quite extensively by the media. And I mean, because that was just shocking. It was really, really, you know, eventually overturned at the Supreme Court. And then we just carried on as normal, you know. And then, of course, we ended up bringing about the general election. But as soon as the general election came and passed, they've got a majority. It's like, okay, and continue. It's just, it is nuts. How many unprecedented things do we need to watch before that people actually... And then you look at the... you know, the support for the Tories in Westminster voting intentions and recent polling, particularly in England and parts of Wales. My goodness.
Aye. I mean, what do you say that when hundreds of thousands dead, massive corruption blatantly in show, and they're still hitting mid-40% in terms of approval ratings? It's, somebody explain that to me because I don't understand it.
It's really hard to explain when you're sitting from up here, I think, because generally in Scotland we're like, what the fuck anyway, do you know what I mean? Like, but now I think maybe it's the, you know, from going down to London and speaking to some friends, particularly people on the left and things, nobody's enthused by Starmer or anything like that. So it could be more of a well, you know, I'm not really feeling this guy, not that I'm defending it, but it's like, you know, nobody's motivated. He's not going to get the vote out. We've seen that in Hartlepool. I think that was the biggest example. The left vote didn't come out. They didn't feel motivated to come out. Whereas in Scotland, we've seen even with tactical voting in certain seats, the SNP vote was still turning out. The left vote was still turning out. And they just don't have that down in England at the moment. So
that's English politics has got, and the Tories have managed to get themselves in this amazing position of just being the sort of default. It reminds me when Alex Ferguson was managing Manchester United, every year I always thought, when you'd look at it, and if there was an outstanding team, you'd think, oh, they might win it. But if there wasn't, if you looked at it, thought, there's not an outstanding team, Man United would usually win it. Alex Ferguson's team would usually win it. And it's like that down in England. It seems as if, unless Labour are looking really strong, or they've got this leader that seems to be really popular and cutting through, if they look at it and go, no, not really, I will just stick with the Tories then.
And even Cummings as well, you know, the Leave guy that was, you know, had everybody on side, that, you know, the Brexiteers were loving the fact that, you know, Cummings was advising there, and even he's come out and said all this stuff. It's not even dent, he's not even made a difference. It's fascinating.
I think the Labour in England, the biggest problem for them is they aren't really an opposition, really. They're just bystanders, aren't they? They're just sort of there.
Critical friend.
Yeah.
You
wouldn't want them to be divisive.
Exactly. This is coming back to, you know, you didn't want to be divisive. And it's like, so Labour's going to go, oh, well, you know, if you want to do this policy, but we think perhaps you should just change this deck chair to that position, and then that'll make it okay. You know, I think this is basically where we were at with Labour. And yeah, the official opposition, which is ironic, you know, we don't have an official opposition in Scotland. We have more opposition in certain parties in Scotland than we have the official opposition at Westminster. It's just depressing.
Yeah, Labour leadership, and a little boxer that's scared to throw a punch. Like,
And it's like, I'm a Republican, get me out of here. This is to get out of the union. Like, you know.
Devo Max, Brian, that's what we need. Nah, Alba Rising.
Hashtag Max the Devo.
Max the Devo. It is very Gordon Brown-esque, you know, the whole Labour sort of attitude since Gordon Brown. It became more and more, you know, about placating the English Tory voters. And I think that's what, you know, they're obviously trying to get their numbers up. But I think the Labour, true Labour supporters are still there. I just think they must have abandoned their right to vote, because I don't know why people vote Tory anyway, no matter where they are. Like, I don't understand
And yeah,
probably because I'm poor. That's probably what.
Correct.
Exactly. But I think too that the voting system in England has a huge part to play in that, because you know, if you've got first past the post, you've got two big players. You know, Tory, like you're saying, is the Alex Ferguson. They're in a strong position. And if you're not motivated by the other guy, then you're just not going to turn up to vote. Whereas you know that in the Scottish elections that we've just voted in, I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about my choices in the first past the post constituency option, but I felt motivated because I know that my, you know, the second AMS vote would make a difference, and it did. So I think that, you know, even down to the council elections being first past the post in England, it's like, literally, it's just Labour Tory. And now we're starting to see that slightly shift in some of the local elections to Green in some places, Sheffield, for example. But yeah, I just think in Westminster, even, you know, well, Greens are now polling between 7% and 9% in the voting intentions in Westminster, and it still says in the voting conversion that they're going to get one seat. So it's just, it's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not exactly sympathetic, but even saw that with UKIP, mm-hmm. who at mm-hmm. their height in England were polling really, really highly and still were kind of shut out of actually getting a seat in Westminster.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think that, what did they even get? It was like way into the double figures, wasn't it? And they still, you know, one or two seats that they got in a general election or whatever. It just shows you the first past the post system is designed to keep the status quo.
Yeah, well, I think they get a couple of MPs basically the same way as Alba did, by having a couple of defections. And I think they retained one of these seats, but I think that was it. That's the best they've done.
Well, they got Brexit, didn't they, after that?
They didn't need to get elected, did they?
Yeah.
if only we could get the same with something that was positive. Do you know what I mean? You know, if we got the Green New Deal and we only had one, you know, Caroline Lucas, the only Green MP in there, and managed to bring about a radical Green New Deal, then, you know, that would be positive. But, you know, I won't hold my breath.
Well, I mean, you know, Corbyn's rise was kind of out of nowhere and unexpected, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that coming at all. Like, in fact, I don't think Corbyn saw that coming when he basically took his turn to be the standard bearer for the ever-diminishing left of Labour. And then was suddenly sitting there riding, like, well and clear in first place amongst the other challengers. So there is, and there's plenty of criticisms of Corbynism, but they certainly seem to be as if they were drawing a lot more support than, you know, Starmerism. I don't think I've even heard the word Starmerism, which kind of says enough in itself.
It sounds a bit.
It brings us almost full circle to the point you were making about the peerage. Mm. He's Sir Kieran Starmer, isn't he? He's a knight. is that what it's called? A knight? He was knighted.
Yeah, knighthood.
Yeah. Does he get to ever sit in the House of Lords then? Did he, like, when he retires?
No, I think a knighthood's different for a peerage.
Is it? I don't know. They all have big swords, don't they?
I'm sure we'll see that at some point. Based on my
thorough knowledge of Game of Thrones, a knighthood is definitely different from a lord.
All right, I'm very sorry. I'm so uncouth. Can you tell your knights for your peers, for your... what's the other one you get? OBEs?
An MBAs.
Yeah. Ach, it's all rubbish, isn't it?
I mean, that is a thing, like, because when there was, Starmer was sort of portrayed as a sort of reconciliation figure between the left and the right. He was not quite a Corbyn sort of figure, but he was sympathetic to the left and would be fair.
Mm.
I was always sceptical with that, basically, exactly for what you said there, Deborah. You know, the guy's a knight, you know, like... Who's really, can you really say, is left wing if they're accepting knighthoods for the Queen? You know, how establishment can you get? And he's proven that. He's the only time he's looked like he's got any hint of a backbone is when he's attacking, like, people on the left in his own party, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, not letting Corbyn back into the party. I mean, that was, you know, and ultimately, you know, he was kind of like marketed as a sort of, oh yeah, you know, he'll unite the party, we'll get everybody back together, you know, and then of course he ends up not letting Corbyn back into the party. So, but after serving on the front bench of Labour under Corbyn, and also being responsible for one of the policies of positioning UK Labour going into that general election on Brexit, which was, as I said, never going to be popular with certain areas that Labour heartlands, or the red wall, which is just thrown about these days, you know, was never going to be popular with the sort of target voters. So it's quite interesting that he was even pretending or marketed as this person that was going to bring the party back together, and look how that's going. Not very well.
I'd actually forgotten about that, about Corbyn, that he's not actually technically a Labour MP.
Nope.
I heard it mentioned last week, and I was like, oh, that's right. I remember the sort of, you know, the uproar when it first happened, but it just completely slipped my mind. You know, and I mean, what is he expecting to gain for that? Does he really think he's going to, the likes of the Daily Mail is going to pat him in the head and get support for doing something like that? You know, in reality, he's alienating, you know, a lot of the people that joined the party because of Corbyn.
Pretty much.
A lot of the youth vote as well, a Labour, because you know, which is a bit naive of the guy.
Definitely. And I think it all comes down to the vote not coming out. I don't think it's so much that people are necessarily at the point where they're like, you know, I'm not voting Labour, I'm definitely going to vote for Tory because that's a much, much better option. But then again, you know, the Greens have now overtaken the Lib Dems, by the way, which is something that's interesting. But yeah, I think it's like 6% and 9% now in certain polls. So, I mean, it's not like there's been a huge Green surge on the back of, you know, Labour not doing so well. But I just think it's about voter engagement and getting that vote out. And I think if there was a general election, I think it would be a disaster for Labour if there was a general election tomorrow. But then again, you know, he's just playing the slow game. He's not playing any game. Or if he is, he's doing it really badly.
Yeah, the Green Party, England and Wales, have kind of been building gradually over a long time now, like getting their base in Brighton. Mm-hmm. And sort of building from there. Corbyn, the rise of Corbyn sort of inhibited their growth for a while, because a lot of the people that would be drawn to the Greens were then drawn to a Corbynite Labour Party. But, you know, it's really just went back to pre-Corbyn sort of trends, the fact that the Greens in England are slowly sort of gaining more and more support. But like you said, the voting system, it just makes it so difficult for any kind of significant breakthrough.
There was a great piece written by, so I can't remember the guy's name, but he wrote it just before the general election about the growth of the Green Party. And, you know, they're second place and second or third place in some of the seats like Bristol West and Isle of Wight. But he was saying that essentially what the Green Party needs to grow in England and Wales is for there to be a Labour government that becomes unpopular. And that's how they won Brighton. Because it was such a long, strong Labour seat, and the Greens were pitched as to the left of New Labour, and that's how they won the seats. So, you know, until they get back into that sort of position, that they might struggle to actually grow to the extent to which they need to. So it's quite an interesting perspective, and I agree with it to some extent.
Yeah. The other option, though, is... Sorry, only with Emma.
Oh, well, I was just going to say the other option is we destroy the Tories. I don't know what you're going to say.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Sounds a bit Bond villain.
I'm just trying to be divisive.
I've just got to say, like, you know, Labour are actually hitting the kind of levels, though, that I think they're still kind of holding about 30 to 35% at times in the polls, but they don't, like you were both saying, they don't seem like an opposition. So there is a chance for, you know, the Greens to, you know, be that left opposition, because despite the fact Labour have so much more influence and sort of seats and, you know, 100 years of history in Westminster, you know, they're not playing a glove on the Tories, so somebody's got to.
It's the ideal sort of, you know, context for Labour to really build on that and become such a strong opposition. I just don't understand how somebody can get it so wrong. Like, I mean, there's so many things that, that could be done, like actually having proper policies in place. I can't name a UK Labour policy because there isn't one. No, they can. And, you know, you would think, right, these are the simple things, you know, these are the three key things that we want to try and get into people's heads before the next general election. You know, all I know about is the fact they didn't want to tax corporations more because we were in a pandemic, which doesn't sound very Labour to me. And even the G7 disagrees with that. So we can see just how off the scale that was. But other than that, I can't actually name a policy that Labour would bring in. But I can rhyme off loads from the Corbyn times.
That's what I was going to say, though. You know, you have that sort of Labour centrist who, they're so convinced how their own cleverness, you know, they'll be saying, we don't need policies. Look what happened on Corbyn, their policy. They said it was broadband communism. So their answer is, let's just not have any policies. If we've got any policies, they kind of criticise us. And it's like, well, no, they'll find something else to criticise you on. It just means you've got nothing to argue about in favour of.
Let's just be critical friends instead. Critical friends of the government. And that phrase will stay with me the whole time that Keir Starmer's in office, whilst all these people are dying in this country and across the UK. Critical friend was what Labour was during that.
Friend.
Critical friend, just and just disgraceful.
I was going for an in-between us reference there.
I know.
Friend. It was quite icky, wasn't it? Seeing that there was an open goal there for Keir Starmer really to, you know, make a bit of a name for himself and for Labour to really get tore into the Tories, and he didn't.
Was this the Piers Morgan interview? They said that. Did you see that? No.
No.
I didn't see it either. I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
I've muted the words Piers Morgan on my Twitter, so I probably didn't know it even existed. Sorry.
He done a sit-down interview that apparently he cried about his mum and things like that. And it was again, one of the really clever centrist advisors probably thought this was going to, how he was going to smash it and everybody would suddenly love, you know, Keir Starmer after this. And it's like, yeah. Because Piers Morgan, he's the route to the working class.
Just a real sympathy for anyone that's lost a parent and all that kind of thing.
I don't think he's just. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think his mother's dead. I don't know what. I don't know the context of him crying about it.
I know. Was it not during the leadership campaign? I think it was his wife's partner, or was it his mum that was really unwell? I can't remember exactly what it was, but yeah, Piers Morgan's interviews, first of all, are terrible, unless you're Jerry Halliwell. but yeah, it's never the root of any sort of popularity, is it?
No, I was just talking about in general, whenever I saw him speaking at First Minister's Questions or making any sort of statement, like Brian was saying, he was just a sort of mundane, slight criticism. Oh, should he really be doing that? Instead of, he should be more prepared. He's the Prime Minister, getting stuck, you know, right into the Tories' total ineptitude. They didn't do that.
He's like a QC as well or something, is he not?
Apparently.
Like, you know, absolutely nail something like PMQs, but he just comes across as so, like an attack to a wet blanket.
And then all the centrist media going, yeah, he's so forensic.
Forensic, that was the word.
Yeah, so forensic, but clearly not very forensically good at getting the polls in his favour.
Right, I think we should move on now, right? We're
just ranting now.
Poor old greeting Keir Starmer. So also this week, there was a couple of high-profile moves within the SNP. Douglas Chapman, the SNP treasurer, quit. Made sort of vague allusions about not being able to get enough information to do the job. Then Joanna Cherry sort of flounced off the NEC, talking about transparency and scrutiny. So Nicola Sturgeon came out and says that she had no concerns about the SNP's finances. And I think this is in reply to a lot of sort of conspiracy theories that's been floating around sort of since before, during the election campaign about claims that there's police investigations, which I think was denied as well by John Spinney, to do with missing money and donated money. What are people's thoughts?
Well, I tried to do my usual and find out a wee bit more about it from inside, and I got offered the branch treasury report. But we get offered that every month, so that was no biggie. I don't really know what the big deal is. They're moaning about these funds, and as far as I can tell, the SNP funds are quite healthy just now, even though we just ran a campaign. And they say ring-fenced. I don't think that means they're actually sitting in a fence somewhere. Like, the way some of these people are going on, it's as if they don't understand a huge organisation with different assets and how they can get moved about. I don't know. I just think that the people who were moaning about it have flounced off anyway to another party. So nobody I've spoken to in the SNP seem to have any concerns about it. They says the funds are there when we need them, basically.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the certain types of people that seem to be resigning from positions like Douglas Chapman, Joanna Cherry. Joanna Cherry stood on a platform to say, I'm going to go in and unearth and be transparent about the NEC. And it was almost like a protest vote, I think, that quite a few of these types of people who have all left the party and went to ALBA, you know, wanted to stand to be on the NEC, so they were in a position of power to, you know, bring about change, to, you know, shed some light on all these dark corners of SNP. But then they just resigned because they couldn't. And it's just, yeah, just, it seems a little bit coordinated as well, doesn't it? Douglas Chapman, and then 2 days later, Joanna Cherry, I'll be making no further comments at this time, type mm-hmm. tweet. Just seems very coordinated.
I'm right in saying certainly Joanna Cherry, but am I right in saying both of them there was a lot of speculation that they would defect to ALBA before the election?
Yeah, but I think with Joanna Cherry, she's obviously quite a bright individual and was obviously seeing how things were playing out, I think, before any decisions were going to be made. I think that both Douglas Chapman, and I'll double check after this to make sure that I'm 100% correct, that Douglas Chapman, when the SNP, first of all, were going to abstain on the votes for same-sex marriage in Northern Ireland, I think he didn't vote in favour of it for Northern Ireland, Douglas Chapman as well. So I think that's just quite interesting. Mm-hmm. So LGBT issues falling mm-hmm. into play there a little bit. And also there's the issues around the GRA with Joanna Cherry. So, you know, there's sort of alignment there with ALBA. So it just kind of seems that there's maybe a certain section or certain group of people, elected members in SNP, that all seem to have very similar views when it comes to how the SNP is ran and how it's operated. I'm sure there's loads of criticisms about how the SNP operates because it's a huge political party. It's the same with all big organisations. But if you're actually going to come up with something that's going to be quite damaging, I'm sure there's stuff actually there rather than just trying to make a story out of something that can be easily refuted, particularly if you're mentioning financial things, which has to be regulated anyway. Mm-hmm. And involvement of the police, which can be checked. You know, I seen John Swinney on the Sunday show, and that was brought up saying, you know, apparently there's police investigating such and such. And he was like, well, I'm not aware of that.
Yeah, he denied it.
Yeah. So, of course, is there anything going on? I very much doubt it, because if it's something to do with finances, it's very easily to be traced back. I mean, we've just spoken about the Tories, who are so blatant about taking a donation of half a million pounds, or no, half a million, from a new peer, that they have to be blatant about it because it's documented. We will find out about it. If they didn't mention it and then that just appeared on the front page of the Sunday Mirror, then that would be a huge slash. So I think if there was anything to do with the finances of a political party, I think that the bigger story would be not saying anything about it and it just being unearthed. So that's just my thoughts.
I know from branch and constituency level that the people who are in charge of these things take their job very, very seriously, and they're very diligent in all their reporting because that's the sort of folk they are. So I can't imagine at the next level up it's going to be, you know, any different. Like you say, it's got to be documented. They've got to tell us what's happened. And a lot of the stories are all coming for, you know, a certain blogosphere, shall we say. That's where all the irateness originates, as far as I could see when I was trying to find out for the podcast.
A lot of the sort of internet rumour mills about this that keep popping up again, it's all so vague. They keep talking about a 600 grand crowdfunder. But I mean, what are they suggesting? Are they suggesting that, you know, Sturgeon's put that in their back pocket and bought another coffee machine with it? Or, you know, they're never sort of blatant about those kind of allegations. It's always just kind of open sort of, oh, where did the money go? And it's like, well, the money probably went a lot of places. It's a big political party and they're running different things. And, you know, I don't think people realise that just because, oh, I gave it for this, well, you donated it to the SNP, you don't really get to dictate exactly how it's spent. You know, they did say it would be for independence, but then you could easily justify anything the SNP do and say, well, it's for independence. Certainly, if you're talking about a legal sort of thing, it doesn't really hold water. But what it does remind me of is there's a, in terms of finances, there's been quite documented stuff about Rangers in the last 10 years about finances. And if you look at Celtic Twitter and a lot of the Celtic-based bloggers, going back the last 10 years, there'll be somebody that is claiming the police investigation has been launched. It's all going to come out this Friday, and then it comes and goes. But there was one day where Rangers did go into administration, so that then gave credence for 10 years for every other blogger to know that's now kind of got their own crowdfunders, that they have to keep promising that something big's going to happen. Next week, if you just felt, you know, donate to my crowdfunder, and then next week we'll lock him out, the shit's going to hit the fan. You know, one day they'll be right, because you keep saying something's going to happen, something will happen eventually. Might not be exactly what you said, but, you know, it'll be in the sort of the realm of possibility that you can then turn and go, told you, donate to my crowdfunder.
Keep giving me money so I can expose this thing that's going to happen in 10 years' time. But it's, I think, like, obviously, when it comes to finances of political parties, yeah, it's highly regulated. But I think that, you know, look at the Natalie McGarry story as well, that kind of came out when she was elected as an MP and she was taking money from, I know it wasn't SNP funding, I don't think, but it was like, you know, Women for Indy and all these types of groups and whatever. This sort of stuff does come out. Like, it's going to come out, particularly, you know, if you're claiming to be a political party or a, you know, raising money for, you know, public good or for a charity or for all these types of things, it's all going to be documented and it is all going to come out in the wash. So, you know, these types of things will come out themselves. We don't need somebody to keep prompting us saying, ah, there's definitely something going on here. Everybody needs to keep their eye on this. But I think that it could have been with Joanna Cherry having an axe to grind about the NEC, because when she decided that she was going to stand to be the candidate for Edinburgh Central, there was a bit of a sort of change to the rules as such for the basically, I think she not have to resign as an MP beforehand, and which to me seems fair because I'm really against dual mandates anyway. And, you know, I think that because the NEC had changed that rule, she felt it was an attack on her, when actually if it was meant to be an attack on her, which I'm not saying it was, but if, you know, if they just didn't want Joanna Cherry to end up in Holyrood and then be in a position where she could challenge to be leadership of the party or whatever, then why didn't they just deal with her and how she presents herself as an MP, how she gets into really difficult conversations and, you know, essentially potentially could be viewed as abusive towards certain people on social media, then just deal with that rather than changing the NEC rules to prevent, you know, being able to stand as a candidate for the Edinburgh Central. Because I know that Neil Gray went through the process because he did resign, didn't he, and then say, I'm going to stand as an MSP, and then, you know, went through that same process that Joanna Cherry didn't want to do. So I just think it just seems like a bit of an axe to grind, particularly in Joanna Cherry's.
Yeah, I remember when that happened, there was a lot of claims that the SNP MPs were trapped at Westminster now because
trapped.
One, you just pointed out that another MP was able to move over to Holyrood before following the new rules. But, you know, I wish somebody would trap me in a 80 grand a year job.
That was Philippa Whitford that said that. And the people, yeah, I think it was anyway, they said that they're trapped in Westminster. And I think that, you know, we need to remember the timeline with Joanna Cherry announcing that she wanted to stand to be the candidate for Edinburgh Central, because it was 4.5 months after the general election, after she had been elected. And I think that in itself is really disrespectful to the people that have just elected you. If you were wanting to, you know, it's perfectly legitimate for Neil Gray to say, do you know what, I want to stand to be in Holyrood because that's where I'd rather be and whatever, that's absolutely fine. But, you know, to be elected by the people in the general election of 2019, clearly knowing that you have the intention to stand to be a candidate for Edinburgh Central, I think it's just really quite revealing as an individual and how some people view their position as an elected member. I think dual mandates, I'm really, really dead against them, but I understand for some smaller parties why, you know, the SNP back in the day, you know, that was, you know, they didn't have a lot of people that put themselves forward or whatever. I don't agree with it, but I understand the argument. But there's no need for it at this point where the SNP has loads of elected members, loads of people putting themselves forward, people wanting to stand and put themselves forward to be councillors, MPs, MSPs. It's unacceptable.
Well, look how much we slag Douglas Ross for being a MP, MSP, leader of a party.
Four and jobs.
Referee.
And then they always say, yeah, but Alex Salmond done it. And I was like, yeah. Nothing to look up to, is it?
But at the same time, you know, there was that period where, when the Scottish Parliament was formed, where there was a lot of people with dual mandates because, well, it was just the nature of it. The Scottish Parliament was new, so a lot of the people had been MPs because there wasn't the option of being an MSP. You know, I suppose we could have had like 40-odd by-elections or 60 by-elections, but you know, I think in that circumstances, you know, a dual mandate was understandable for a wee while. Just the same as I can understand if there's a dual mandate between somebody that's a councillor that then gets elected. I don't think it's a good idea if it runs on for years and years. Like if you've just been elected and you immediately jump ship.
Jed Kellen done that, yeah.
Yeah, it was for like a year or so.
I think...
Particularly the council with this voting system as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you stand, you could get elected in a kind of multi-member ward and have a really good sort of support and be, you know, a part of the Greens could be... I think it happened with them in Leith Lock. Mm-hmm. They had a councillor there who stood down and they ended up just losing that seat because the by-election is effectively a first-past-the-post because there's only one seat up for grabs. So that obviously then favours the bigger, more established parties.
Mm-hmm.
So I have some sympathy for dual mandates depending on the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
None of those exist for Douglas Ross, who is just trying to hold on to as many jobs and as much pay packets as he can, from what I can see.
Mm-hmm.
But it brings us on nicely as well. Douglas Ross, friend to the LGBT community, as he was wearing his pride badge. I don't think he was physically in Parliament. I think it was in a. He was in. What is it? It's no Zoom. They use Skype, whatever it is. But he was electronically in Parliament, wearing his pin badge. Thoughts?
Go on, Deborah.
I will. His voting record isn't very gay friendly, is it? It's not very. Let's wave the pride flag. What he voted against allowing marriage between two people of the same sex in 2019, and a mixture of for and against between 2004 and 2019. He also generally voted against laws to promote equality and human rights. A Tory, not a fan of human rights. Shock, horror. And he also voted against equal gay rights in as recently as 2019. So take your wee badge and shove it, because I think it's just performative, as far as I'm concerned. It's nae ally to me.
Coming for the folk that are up moms about virtue signalling. This is like the ultimate virtue signalling. Mm-hmm. You know, try to portray yourself as an ally to the LGBT community, and literally the only thing you've done is wear a badge and you want some kind of credit for that when you've done absolutely nothing to help gay people.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think, as Robin S. fantastically said, actions do speak louder than words. And, you know, when your voting record reads as abysmally as Douglas Rossi's and many of his colleagues, mm-hmm. by the way, this is not just the leader of the Scottish Conservatives. You know, people like Murdo Fraser and Liz Smith voted against equal marriage in the Scottish Parliament. I think it was 2013 the vote was, maybe slightly before that. So yeah, absolutely agree with what Deborah was saying. It's very performative. It's almost like, you know, it's sort of like expected. You know, it's almost like, you know, when, you know, Remembrance comes around, it's like, yeah, everyone, make sure you've got that poppy on. You're on the BBC, get the poppy on. It's Pride Month, you know, get your Pride flag on. I think it's particularly angering at the moment with how Pride Month is playing out for a lot of queer people
mm-hmm.
at the moment, particularly trans and non-binary people. I get really, really angry about these type of things, particularly Conservative government at Westminster, you know, dismantling their LGBT committee, now talking about withdrawing from a Stonewall initiative for equal employment. You know, GRA is a mess in most parliaments across the UK. Conversion therapy discussion. Yeah, take your pride flag and shove it, because I really don't need to see performative gestures from people who have no respect for human rights, whether it be gypsy travellers, whether it be gay mm-hmm. people, whether it be people of colour. I have absolutely no interest in you people wearing a flag to conform to what you think should be right during Pride Month.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind as well, Douglas Ross has only been a parliamentarian since 2016.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so somebody being elected in 2016, it would be very easy just to even pay lip service to LGBT community in that sense. It's not like somebody who has been a parliamentarian for decades during, like, you know, section
28.
And huge things in the 80s that maybe in hindsight find that they were caught on the wrong side of history. This is somebody only been a public figure for a few years, and he's already sort of, you know, failed in terms of, you know, the gay marriage thing was going to happen. Why not just vote for it then? You know, if you're going to pay lip service, at least you could pay lip service in a way it might matter.
I seen a statement from Douglas Ross on why he didn't vote for it at the time, and it was because he couldn't ignore the hundreds of thousands of people who had voiced you know, opposition against it. And I was thinking, what? So you're like standing up for bigots? What? Like, I just, as Brian says, it's obviously very emotive. And the thing that only gives me comfort is the first Pride was a riot. So if we can have a big fight about it, I'm happy about that. Like, why? why is he wearing that wee pin? Like, I really wish we could just phone him up and ask him and be like, why did you wear it? See what his answer is. Because the only reason it can be is, you know, to act like one of your pals. And he's most definitely not.
Yeah. Just echo everything that you've just said again. And it is so emotive. And I think because normally, because I haven't actually seen like your real widespread hostility during Pride for a long time. I think there's always been bigots. There's always been, you know, what was the guy from the DUP talking about same-sex couples on Dancing on Ice? People shouldn't be watching that type of thing. And it almost became a bit of a joke because it was such an outsider view. Pride generally was, there was things that we needed to move forward with, and there's been great progress, you know, gay men, men who have sex with men, able to give blood, you know, coming around this summer, things like that, you know, real positive.
Long overdue,
you know, situations that are starting to be dealt with. But now it just seems the resistance is so bad. We've seen just the last couple of days, David Paisley, who is a huge advocate for trans rights, deals with so much on Twitter and social media, you know, having to leave his home because he felt unsafe. So he's gone to somewhere he feels safe during Pride because he feel, you know, for standing up for trans rights. And you have people, gender criticals, and I'm using the inverted commas there, and saying, you know, oh, we want to see proof that you feel unsafe. We want to see proof that you've been threatened. Yet these people are saying that, you know, that you know, trans rights are going to infringe on the safety of people, of women who are going to face abuse. Yet these same people are demanding somebody who has left their home because they feel unsafe, they're demanding for proof. And it just exposes the whole facade for what it is. And, you know, Douglas Ross, you know, just shove your pride flag. And if you want to, you know, rather than wearing your pride flag, first of all, apologize for your really, really offensive stances on things in the past, and then we'll talk. But whilst you're at it, pal, the trans people are really, really facing some really, really horrible environment at the moment, just as horrible as refugees and immigrants coming to this country that your government is responsible for. So if you want to try and deal with all of this, you know, make your apologies, come forward with some progressive ideas on how to change it, and then you can maybe wear your pride flag.
I think that's really important what you've just said. I think it's really important for all organisations, any politicians, any big bodies, supermarkets, banks, whatever, that want to wave their pride flag, they have to come out and actually be allies. And the trans folk right now, they are facing relentless harassment on Twitter, on social media. In the media, you've got journalists coming out saying ridiculous, stupid statements. And it's like, hello, the 1950s called, they want their binary sexism fucking back. It's so tedious and it's so boring, and I think it's so offensive. And David Paisley feeling unsafe, I mean, he's a big boy. And you could see the harassment. You can see it. It's so frustrating, and it's just fabricated nonsense. It's outdated tropes. And we've spoke about this before, and it makes me so angry and gets me so agitated. You're right, this is Pride Month. Show a bit of pride. Pride is that. Pride is shaking hands and being friends and agreements between one another and saying, we'll stand up for your rights, you stand up for our rights. Oh, I'm so annoyed. I'm just ranting. I'm sorry. Happy Pride, everybody.
No, I know. I know exactly how you feel. And I think that it really comes down, particularly with gender criticals, you know, voicing legitimate concerns around, you know, the fear of abuse and gender-based violence that women massively disproportionately face. And I think that when you have people who are rightly standing up for trans people and basically being, you know, because I had a Twitter account that I deleted during lockdown, because I was being very vocal in support of trans rights and the relentless abuse that I was receiving. And, you know, being called an abuser, being called misogynistic, I hate women, using language of abusers. And I think for me, that's really close to home, because I know a lot of women and men that are really close to me in my life that have faced sexual abuse, domestic abuse, all of these types of things. And I think that when you're trying to label people as that, when they're trying to stand up for minorities, is really, really damaging. And I know that David Paisley has experience of that in his family and with people that he knows. And that must be absolutely horrendous, constantly facing this. And it's not just, you know, I'm using David Paisley as an example here because it's one that's really prominent in my mind. There's other people, all the trans people out there that are facing relentless abuse, and their allies are just, you know, facing this relentless abuse. And it's just, it just needs to stop. And we need the mainstream media, The Guardian. I can't even talk about that yet because I'm just so angry and frustrated at The Guardian. You know, we just need to give, first of all, give these people a break, and then everybody just take a breather for 5 minutes, shake hands, and actually, you know, start sticking up for minorities in this country, because I'm just at the point now where it's just ridiculous. Happy Pride, everyone.
Like you said there, but I would like to have been in the room to see, like, you know, why did he put it on? Like, and I just wonder, is within sort of certain political circles, is a pride flag sort of just became one of the symbols that politicians just pick up and put on without thinking about it? The way, like, oh, November's coming up, where's my poppy? You know, they don't really particularly care much about veterans or the horrors of the First World War, but, well, they're a politician, so they better wear a poppy, because, you know, because it's October and Remembrance Sunday's coming up. Just the way American politicians try to find American politician that doesn't have one of the wee flags, one of the wee, you know, enamel American flag badges. And again, it's like, it means nothing. It's just part of the uniform of being a politician. And maybe this kind of reaction that he's had just shows that, you know, people aren't ready for the pride flag just to become an empty symbol, that it still means something.
It's like poppyism, really, isn't it? I don't know if that's been coined. I don't know. It's like poppyism. It's like, you know, and some politicians do it, particularly conservatives, when it's World AIDS Day as well. That gets my goat particularly for how hostile, blatantly hostile, the Conservatives were during the AIDS crisis, and continually not supporting people abroad who are suffering from widespread HIV and AIDS, crises. So, yeah, it's like a poppyism. It's like, oh, I need to be seen to be doing the right thing. Well, you know, what should I be wearing this week? You know, what's the special day of the week? You know, actually, you should want to do these things. You should want to stand in solidarity with these groups of people and minorities, rather than thinking, okay. And it's almost like there must be some, you know, Tory staffer saying, oh no, 1st of June, there's your pride badge. I ordered you a special one this year, you know. And yeah. I don't know if he's wearing the one with the salt tire on it as well to look like he's not being too unionist. I don't know. So it's just... Yeah, I'm not going to, I was going to swear, but I'm not going to swear again. I think I've swore already today, so
I'll swear.
Not going to swear again. Yeah.
Fucking yes, queen. Like, yeah. Everything you just said, yes.
So, yeah. Happy Pride, everyone. And, you know, let's try not to get too... Clearly, I'm in a mind frame today. but I'd like to, you know, talk about all the positive things that Pride brings about, because we can't all be together in these big marches. We can't all be together. And we'd really like to be, because we'd like to stand in solidarity with our trans siblings. And we can't. But we can do it on social media. And we can, most importantly, not just putting out tweets about it or putting Facebook posts about it or sharing these ridiculous articles that are being churned out and slagging them off. It's about talking to your friends and family, because most people, first of all, don't fully understand the issues that at stake here. And, you know, they take these little sound bites and they might vocalize them and say, what does this actually mean? And it's about educating people. about sending people links saying, do you understand what's actually at stake here? All we're talking about is birth certificates. When's the last time you used a birth certificate? Exactly. I don't even know where mine's is. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, this is what we're talking about here. And it's about educating our friends and our families and educating people about, you know, the risks that, that women face in gender-based violence, about, with particularly amongst, you know, men, cis men, that exist, people they know, people they work with, people that might be connected with them in some other way. Let's talk about these real issues about sexual violence, about gender-based violence, domestic violence. These are all really important, but they're also what trans people face. And yeah, let's try and take some of the positive things and have really, really good discussions with people and just, you know, get rid of the nonsense and talk about the things that are really, really important. But standing in solidarity with the minorities and fighting the oppression that so many minorities face.
Yeah. What you said there, just about changing the sex on your birth certificate, I had a breakthrough with one of my friends who was really upset about this self-ID and was going off in all the tropes. And I just tried to rationalize it by saying, imagine on your passport, your driver's license, or your birth certificate, your name was wrong and it had, you know, the wrong date of birth or something, or the wrong sex, or you, the wrong marital status. You can call up and get that changed. Yeah. And they'd be like, well, I would hope so. And I was like, well, that's all trans folk want. It's literally about a state of equality. And it's been so blown out of proportion by, all I can say is, nefarious characters. That's how it comes across to me, motivated by something else. Like, why would you not want someone to have the same rights as you? I don't understand. I just, it makes me so annoyed. But yes, it's Pride Month, everybody. Happy Pride Month. Go and watch happy films, but that are also quite sad, like Pride, like Stonewall, like It's a Sin. You know, go and watch these films and learn if you don't know. And if you're gay, go and just watch them and cry about it.
Yeah, and get angry and get mobile. Yeah.
And that's, get riotous.
Get riotous. But yeah, so, you know, there's so much positive stuff that can come out of Pride if, you know, if we look for the important things. Look past the rainbow, empty capitalism. Look past, you know, politicians wearing their Pride flags when they didn't really care. And look at the solidarity that exists in the communities, in the working class communities specifically, and take energy from that. Don't allow yourself, your battery, to run low because of the real negative. Twitter is not reflective of reality. You know, it's not reflective of reality. And most people either don't know, ambivalent, or want to know about these issues. And it's so much more, worth your while talking to people about these issues than tweeting angrily about it, because it doesn't achieve anything. That's my message.
On that note, I think we'll draw it to a close. Another great podcast. I'm sure you'll agree.
Fabulous. You're the chair. Right.
Okay, thanks, guys. Another good podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Sorry for ranting. Happy Pride.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.